Welcome to the Oxford Undergraduate Law Podcast, where we discuss the law and its relationship with society. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Rach, and we are your podcast editors. We will platform academics, practitioners, and experts from different backgrounds on this podcast.
We all want to order our family lives around the values that matter to us, and family law is a means for us to achieve this order. Yet, as societies grow more multicultural and multi-religious, we face a challenge. How can we protect the rights of religious citizens while also enabling them to order their affairs according to their different religions? This issue has arisen particularly in family law, in visitation rights cases such as JNB 2017. In the case of a divorce, what happens when, for example, one parent's gender identity is not accepted by the religion and culture the children are raised in?
Dr. Cummings is the Baker Fellingham College Assistant Professor at St. Catherine's College, Cambridge. He did his undergraduate studies and the Bachelor of Civil Law at Oxford, where he was awarded the Vinerian Scholarship for Best Overall Performance on the Bachelor of Civil Law, and the Law Faculty Prizes in Children, Families, and the State and Comparative Equality Law. He is currently an editor of the University of Oxford Human Rights Hub Journal, and his research is focused on the intersection of family law, human rights law, and religious freedom. I'm delighted to discuss Dr. Cummings' article in the Journal of Law, Religion and State Today, entitled Utilizing Systems Theory and Reflexive Law to Navigate the Collision Between Unconnecting Worlds in Family Law.
Just based on the title of the article, for our viewers, this may sound like a really very complex topic. Perhaps to ground our discussion, I noticed that the phrase unconnecting worlds is a reference to the family court case JNB 2017. Could you tell us first a bit more about this case and how it inspired your analysis?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much for having me. I think this is an incredibly interesting and very difficult case, a very moving case, and in fact, quite a sad one in the end. But this word, this phrase, unconnecting worlds, I found almost to be poetic. The judge was talking about how the people involved in this case, but also the court, they all have such different values and understandings of the world. And for the judge, it was almost as if they lived in or inhabited different moral universes. So JNB is a case concerning childcare arrangements. One parent, the mother, resisted the other parent from spending time or having contact with their children. Now, in family law, that is not at all unusual. This is something that happens very commonly in the courts. What makes this case unusual, as you alluded to, was that one of the parents had transitioned, is living as a transgender woman, and the family and the community do not accept that gender identity, that expression of gender identity. And for them, involvement of this parent would be liable to ostracize the children and cause lots of problems as they grow up. So what I found in that phrase that I did, this unconnecting world, is this striking idea that this case was emblematic of a broader tension between law and society, and how these different systems of our lives, our family lives, our religious lives, our legal adherence, can all demand very different things of us at the same time. And that was what I was interested in writing about this case.
That sounds really interesting. So just briefly, you mentioned like law and religion can tell us to do different things. So I guess the question that like stems from that would be, why do conflicts between law and religion matter?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, just for one thing, you can see this case gives us an example of where it really matters. Here, the religious and cultural identity of the family is conflicting with the legal system and the way that we regulate contact and time spent with children. But more broadly, I think we can see this as sort of having a number of a number of reasons why conflicts of law and religion are very important. Both law and religion demand adherence. They require us to do things or not do things. So when we think about law, laws are usually mandatory. They can prohibit us from doing certain things. They can also regulate our lives. And when the law tells us to do something, there will be consequences for not doing it. And in a child arrangement case, there are some serious consequences for a parent who resists or ignores a court order. So if a court tells you that you should make your children available to see the other parent, and you don't do so, you can be held in contempt of court, you can be fined, you can be made to do unpaid work. There's a whole range of things that the court can do. And religions are also quite similar. They govern our lives. Law and religion both have this sort of regulatory function for a lot of individuals. In terms of religion, I think for a second thing, religious identity is a fundamental part of a lot of people's sense of self. They use religion as a way of understanding the whole world. There's not a stark distinction between their religious beliefs and the way that you see or understand things that are going on in the world. It's difficult to kind of draw a line between the two things. This is what John Rawls calls a comprehensive doctrine. It helps to organize our other beliefs and understandings. And the third thing that I'd like to mention about why these conflicts are so important is something also about this particular context, and something that I find really fascinating, which is that the conflict between law and religion, it isn't a simple one. In fact, within our religious communities, there's a whole variety of different types of people. Some of those people will have, as we see in J&B, diverse gender identities, sexualities. And so for a range of different people, their religious experience is also one that is deeply interwoven with their identities in other domains of their life. So, and this is a piece that I maybe will come back to a bit later, but I was very inspired by the work of Ayelet Shahar, who writes in this tradition of kind of multiculturalism. And what she says is that the religious believer is often forced to make this pernicious choice between their religious identity, belonging to that community, on the one hand, and on the other hand, vindicating their rights as an equal citizen with human rights. And so it was about bringing those two things together, which I also think is a key part of why that clash between law and religion is so important.
Thank you so much for that answer. And next, I guess, in your analysis, you draw a lot on two ideas that may be new to our listeners. So the first is systems theory, and the second is the idea of reflexivity in law. So we can get into this more a little later, but just briefly, what is systems theory and what do different systems look like in our society? And secondly, what does reflexivity mean? And what's a reflexive mode of regulation?
Oh, Rach, these are admittedly very difficult ideas, complicated. So thank you for asking and putting me on the spot. So systems theory is an account of society that focuses on functional differentiation. Now, that sounds like it's more complicated, but what it means is that when we look at society, different systems of life have developed, and those systems have particular functions. They're intended to allow us to do certain things. So society, we can see, is being made up of these different systems which overlap, but which essentially are dealing with different functions of social life. So we have family life, we have religion, we have law, we have politics. And all of these systems are differentiated from each other. They're specialized to help us deal with or to achieve the function that they exist for. So the family is there to make space for intimacy with other people. Religion is so we can understand transcendent questions, so questions that kind of go beyond our understanding of the sort of day-to-day reality. And a key insight is that each of these systems has almost like its own code or its own language. And they construct meaning using that language and their own sort of logic. So when we look at things from the religious point of view, there's a particular language, a particular code that's used to understand the world. The problem is that when we have these different codes, it becomes difficult to translate between them. In fact, some would say it's impossible to see these as having a conversation that goes across law and religion. So reflexive law, which was your sort of second question, develops out of this understanding of society. It says, because it's difficult for different systems to communicate directly, law is going to find it really hard to enforce a particular outcome. So it'd be difficult to regulate the behavior of a religious community directly using law, because law and religion speak slightly different languages. So reflexive law is all about looking for more indirect ways of modifying behavior. It's about trying to do things that sort of influence or incentivize religious communities to regulate themselves, but to do so in a way that is directed to or pointed towards our human rights and our equality objectives. And I think this is a good thing because I think it is more likely to work. I also think it's a good thing because it promotes a degree of autonomy. So religious communities have a bit of freedom about how they realize their own objectives. But I also think it allows believers to articulate those human rights and equality norms within a language that's more meaningful to them. And I think that's a good thing too.
Thank you. On the reflexive mode of regulation, I think it was alluded to in your answer previously, but in your paper, it's set out that there are some like different opinions, right? And then some people may think that the clash between religious norms can result in two different regulatory responses outside of the reflexive mode. So the first would be attempts by secular law to regulate religious norms, and this can be understood as an intrusion on their religious autonomy, or the deference by secular law to religious norms, which could threaten the hegemony of law and the cohesiveness of state and risk causing violations to human rights. So could you explain how these people who believe this may come to these conclusions?
Yeah, that's a really helpful idea. I mean, what we're getting at is that there are different ways in which the state, through its law, relates to different systems, and in this case, relates to religious systems. And what I was trying to get at here is something along the lines of Gunther Teufel, what he calls trilemma, which is actually a sort of a threefold difficulty. It's another great piece of language. And what we're trying to say here is that law, when it tries to directly regulate other systems, is likely to have ineffective outcomes. So in the first case, law might try to impose an outcome and it will simply not achieve that outcome in practice. So even though we regulate for reasons of both practicality, but also maybe to do with the systems theory ideas we talked about before, it's difficult to actually make good on that regulatory outcome. So if you want to achieve equality within a religious community, just regulating for equality is not likely to mean that the believers, the adherents within that community, are going to just immediately understand what that means and start to live out that legal norm within the way they arrange their lives. Secondly, if you were to try to do this, it's possible that the law is actually going to destroy or damage exactly what it is about that religious way of life, that's so valuable and important to the people who inhibit it. So there's a risk there of it also being a destructive force. And the other part that Teubner talks about is unresponsiveness. It's simply that you might try and enforce a norm, and although the community might look like they have taken this on board and they've understood and started to build in equality within their system, in real life, they may not be actually living out that value in the way that you expect or the way that you would have wanted. So this is the idea of this trilemma. When we try to regulate things direct, there's this sort of threefold risk. The other part, which you talked about, was about how law and religion kind of relate to each other here. And the point goes back to the idea of functional differentiation. If you remember, I said a little earlier how law has its own function, and so does religion. So when law starts to take on a religious function, or religion start to take on a kind of a legal quality, there's a risk there that differentiation between these systems starts to collapse. It starts to break down. And this, for systems theorists, is the worst thing that can happen, because complexity, apart from making interesting articles for publication and interesting podcasts, complexity is also really important to how the modern society works. That complexity gives us a lot of freedom, because it means no single system is going to be controlling all aspects of our life. So that's the risk there. When law and religion start to do religious or legal things and vice versa, there's a risk that differentiation breaks down. So those are a few of the ideas that I was trying to get at in the paper, this idea of the trilemma, but also this idea that we might see de-differentiation, the society becoming more simple, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, thank you for your answer. I think that really helps me clarify why this matters, what are the potential implications of how we regulate legal and religious norms. Yeah, so perhaps now we can go slightly more in-depth if our previous conversation wasn't in-depth already. But so in your paper, you propose that systems theory is a way for us to better understand the tension between religion and general law, and as a way to better strike a balance between these competing imperatives. This is a complex claim, and to break this down, perhaps we can first lay out how system theory characterizes the dissonance between these systems, and then we can go into how systems theory can help us understand why current regulatory responses are ineffective. So first, how does systems theory characterize the conflicts between law and religion? So for example, how can systems theory explain how the tension between religion and general law can generate what you call a multicultural vulnerability?
Yeah, so the phrase multicultural vulnerability comes from the work of Eilert, who is a really great scholar of law, religion, multiculturalism, and citizenship. And I think it's good to just start there for a moment. What she's talking about is that when you're within a religious or other sort of cultural group, there's a certain vulnerability that this exposes you to. So on the one hand, if you want to use your legal rights, if you want to use the courts and you want to stand upon your rights, you want to enforce your right to equality, religious freedom, personal family life, all those sorts of rights that you have, doing so is not risk-free. It's not without consequence. So what she's saying is the risk of evoking your rights under the Constitution or within the common law, it has a risk, has a cost. On the other hand, the opposite is also true. If you want to articulate and live out your life as a member of that religious community, there's a risk in terms of that tension with your legal rights and entitlements. And so she talks of this as ideas, this sense of multicultural vulnerability, that the religious believer, who may also be a minority within their own group is exposed to. There's a special degree of vulnerability that this arrangement of law and society exposes them to. So although she's not working from exactly the same sociological tradition, her work is very resonant for these ideas in systems theory. And we can see this in the case that we were talking about, J and B, by articulating your legal entitlements or trying to make a legal claim, this transgender parent risks being excluded and risks harm to the children from also being excluded from that community. So, as we say, systems theory characterizes this as being a conflict between these two systems, where the systems aren't really speaking the same language, and it becomes difficult to articulate your claims in law or in a religious community as a result of that difference in function.
I think that segues really nicely into my next question. So as we've alluded to, there's this debate of orthodox systems theory where differing systems result in a communicative closure, and modified systems theory where differing systems can result in differentiated and multifunctional language. So, for example, religious groups may perpetuate their own like religious legal rules, which may even use the same wording as law. So, for example, the word marriage is used by both civil law and religious laws. So, what's your take on this debate, and how do we understand this issue?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So the sort of traditional account of systems theory is that there is this absolute communicative closure. So it means that quite simply, these codes are entirely their own. They've been specialized. It's a bit like an echo chamber. Over time, the language that's used in one system becomes so specialized, and the logic and the sort of things that pull together that system, the set of rules and norms that characterize it, are so specialized that it's simply not possible to say that one system is speaking to another system. And that's where that really extreme articulation of that trilemma comes from. It's that idea that a concept in one system just quite simply cannot be understood in another. We don't necessarily have to go that far. And in fact, you know, we'll see some scholars have used systems theory, but in a way that attenuates, is a little bit more agnostic on this idea of communicative. And so for example, Sandy Fredman, who's a great scholar, a professor in Oxford, who writes about equality and human rights law, she likes to characterize this as part of a single multifunctional language. There's one language, and it's been particularly specialized in each of these systems. And I think that's quite a compelling way to understand this, because it leaves open a bit more space for communication between the systems to be imagined. I think it's worth remembering that all these different theories about how society work are imperfect. They're ways of which I'm trying to approximate something very, very complicated, which is the whole existence of human life. So I always think that we need to be careful not to assume that we are truly describing the behavior of people and the communications we make. I think we have to be open to the possibility that there might be different ways of understanding systems and how systems might relate or communicate rather with one another.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that really helps me to understand more about the role of these theories in your paper. I think my next question would be that you do say in your paper that the UK courts generally articulate and maintain a divide between legal and religious considerations. So why do you think that the UK does this? And why do you argue as well that this is unrealistic?
So it's an excellent point. There's a great case for any family lawyers. They'll be familiar with a case called G, A Religious Upbringing, where the president, Justice Munby, explains this idea. So it's actually a fairly similar problem. In G, the issue was to do with the religious upbringing of children. One parent wanted a very orthodox Jewish education. The other wanted a slightly more reformed religious education, but that one would have more scope for a broad range of experiences and opportunities. And so Justice Munby was required to make a decision between these two different ideas. And when he does this, he articulated this fundamental idea in English law that religion is not the business of government or the secular courts. That's what Munby says. And so it's fundamental that the law has respect for people's different religious views. That's part of your right to freedom of religion. So it's respectful of religious views. But, and this is what Munby also says, it's coupled with a neutrality, this idea that the state is neutral as between different beliefs. And this is an idea that Rachel Taylor, who's also a professor in Oxford, she describes this as tolerant pluralism, right? So that we are pluralistic, we accept different ways of living and different religious, but we're tolerant as to those differences, but we're tolerant within a certain boundary. There's a certain line at which those beliefs are no longer supportable, no longer acceptable within a democratic society. So this is basic idea in English law that there must be this sort of divide or distinction between the legal and the religious, because the state needs to be neutral as between different ways of living in terms of religious ways of living. Now, I don't think that's entirely unrealistic. So, I mean, from my perspective, I think that law and religion do have different functions, but we can see that in many cases, there's going to be these overlapping circumstances. And even in G, making a decision between these two ways of living, the judge refers to what he sees as fundamental constitutional principles about being reasonable, about equal opportunities, about an open future. He thinks these are reasonable ideas, but they're also laden with certain values too. And it's always important to sort of articulate and interrogate where those values are coming from and what they're saying about different religious, when we apply them, how they relate to those different religious claims as well. So I don't think it's unrealistic, but I think we have to be aware that even when we are purporting to make a neutral decision, we're actually, of course, using certain values to do so. And those values also need to be articulated and defended as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you. So next, just to discuss the case study J&B more closely. So how do we understand J&B through systems theory?
Right. So as we said, J&B, it's part of a number of cases that were decided. And J&B is actually the first instance case. There is an appeal, Re-M, which is a Court of Appeal case, which is perhaps now a little bit more better known than J&B, because the judges in the Court of Appeal fundamentally disagreed with the judge in that case. But what does it tell us about systems theory? It tells us a few things. The first thing, I think, as I said before, it's emblematic of that underlying tension between religious and legal norms. Because on the one hand, there's a very strong articulation by the Court of Appeal of the importance of equality and non-discrimination within the law. On the other hand, there is this equally strong religious and cultural norm that is not as accepting of transgender identity. And the problem we see in this case is when the courts are saying we have to account for this legal principle of equality and non-discrimination when we devise an order, a child arrangement order, where does it lead us? Well, the final case in this saga tells us, it tells us that the relationship between the parties had completely broken down. It was no longer possible to seek any solution for direct or indirect contact between the transgender parent and their children. I find that to be tremendously sad, but it's also something that wouldn't be entirely unexpected when we try to enforce a legal principle, an important legal principle, which I think is fundamental to the UK's constitution and any constitutional democracy: equality and respect for people's human rights. But when you try to enforce that in a particular way, it can be difficult to make good on that promise. And it might end up in an ineffective and, in the end, an outcome which I don't think was good for any of the parties. So I think that's what I would take away from this case. We can see these different systems not really speaking to one another. And we can also see the risks of how we go about enforcing a legal norm like equality within a system where there's a different conception, a different understanding of equality or particular rights to the understanding that exists within the legal system.
So what does reflexive secularity entail in terms of our approach to the treatment of religious norms? So, for example, you say that a reflexive approach entails co-liberation. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. So what does this mean and what does this look like?
Yeah, so I mean, reflexive secularity is the idea of applying this idea of law to the principle, the important principle of secularity. And it's sort of rooting secularity in that systems theory tradition. And I think that the two ideas work together well to help set up a framework for addressing complicated questions where law and religion are concerned with similar subject matter. And of course, I look at this in terms of the family, because that's both something that I'm interested in more broadly, but also an area of our lives which is particularly important and sensitive and personal to each of us. So that's why I take reflexive secularity to be. It's the application of this reflexive idea, the idea of trying to regulate behaviour indirectly, trying to regulate behaviour without directly setting the standards. Instead, it may be better to set out certain parameters that cannot be transgressed, but within those parameters to allow a degree of latitude about how you realise your human rights and equality objectives. And as I said a little bit before, I think this is good because it's likely to promote autonomy, which is an important value. I think it's more likely to be effective in realising those important equality and human rights norms. Those are the very bedrock of what I think is important. And thirdly, I think it's more likely that those within a community can articulate their claims effectively in a way that maybe an outsider can't. Outsiders might not have the understanding of that system, the knowledge, or even the persuasive force that articulating a problem from within a community can have. So I think the law should be encouraging that sort of behaviour, that self-regulatory behaviour. And when that happens, it's more likely to lead to a good, productive outcome as well. So that's sort of what I take to that. Now, this idea of collaboration is just the worst word. Of all the many complex bits of jargon we've mentioned today, collaboration is the worst one. It comes from the regulatory literature, and it really concerns this idea. Well, it's a funny word, maybe one I shouldn't have used, but it explains this basic idea that we can sort of manipulate the rules of the game. It's when we see it in a more positive way, what it's saying is we can change the rules to empower certain voices within a community to give them more space and more weight within that discussion. And when we do this, it makes it more likely that those voices are going to be heard, acted upon, listened to. So it's sort of rigging the game in favor of those actors who are likely to agitate for positive change and articulate a strong case for equality and human rights, recognizing that those voices might need some amplification, a little bit of a head start. But that's all framed within the same idea we talked about, where it's about that kind of localized discussion and problem solving that is more likely to lead to a positive outcome. But when we prioritize those voices, we think it might be even more likely to do so. So that's really what this idea of collaboration is referring to in a slightly more human language.
Thank you so much for explaining that. So you talked a little bit about how reflexive secularity, reflexive regulation is a good way to respect community autonomy. But to me, at first glance, a reflexive approach seems quite value neutral in that they don't really prescribe particular values. But you note as well that no theoretical approach is truly value neutral. And like our attempt at neutrality is in itself a value-laden choice. So why is this the case?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the difficulty, as I said before, is when the state tries to be neutral as between different ways of living, that necessarily is an articulation of a value, a value judgment. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't try to be neutral. That's also not to say that attempts at neutrality are pointless. It's saying that when we refer to neutrality, we should try to articulate those underlying values. So remember in G, we said the judge was saying that the state has no business in deciding which religions are right or wrong. But the judge went on to articulate some values like equality, equal opportunities, the open future that children are entitled to aspire to. And so he was articulating some underlying values that he was going to then use to decide between these two options of a very orthodox education or a slightly more liberal and reformed religious education. So I don't think reflexive regulation generally is or can be neutral. But what I was getting at here is it's really I'm borrowing something from the literature that's developed in a lot of very different places. So reflexive law is used in all sorts of places, like regulating water companies and financial markets. And these are places where, of course, there are values engaged. But perhaps the value choices are less obvious than they are when we're looking at family and religious life. Here, the difference in values is very clear. So what I was getting at here is that when we use reflexive law in this way, we're not just using it as a tool, as a way of realizing the state's objective, like cleaning up the water, making sure we have clean water and cheap prices, or making sure that the financial market is efficient and doesn't take advantage of monopolies or manipulate things in ways that we don't want them to. Here, it's not quite as simple as that. We're not trying to just achieve some clear-cut objective or outcome. We are working through different values. And so that's why I think reflexive secularity is informed by values that we need to articulate openly, and also, which is a bit more controversial, that those values also need to be informed by the things we learn from religious communities when they're acting too. It's more of a conversation. The state needs to be open to also reconsidering and reflecting on those initial values and what we've learnt from how they are realized in a particular community.
So just perhaps to just lead on from that, to me, reflexive law also appears to focus quite a lot on procedure, right? So how would you place human rights within the framework of reflexive law?
Yeah, it's such a good argument. I mean, this idea between process and substance is a really important one within human rights literature. There are academics who focus in on this idea of process, dialogue, deliberation. And there are also those who take a more substantive approach. And as I've just been saying, that there's a little bit of a false distinction between process and substance. Those processes are informed by underlying substantive values. And those substantive values need to be brought into being. They don't exist just on their own. We need certain processes that will give effect to them. So what reflexive secularity is about is indeed focused with a lot of process-oriented things, but those processes are geared at achieving particular substantive outcomes, here equality and human rights. And so the success of reflexive secularity is not just that the processes work well, but also that we do tend towards a more equal society that respects people's differences and respects people's rights as both religious individuals, but also as citizens as well. That's that idea that we talked about earlier from Ayelet Shahar's work. Shahar is saying that distinction needs to be broken down. We need to see people as both religious believers and bearers of rights. And so this is my kind of working through of her problem. This is how I think we could achieve that.
Thank you so much. I think I've learned a lot today, and I've really overturned a lot of my preconceived notions about human rights law and family law. Just to conclude, I have two different questions. So first of all, how did you get into family law? And my second question would be, I noticed that you've done a lot of volunteer work at Hunter Combe Legal Aid Clinic, which deals with immigration and asylum issues. So how has volunteering informed your views as to human rights law and as to your academic practice?
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, lovely questions. I mean, so the first one about family, I didn't do family law for my undergrad degree. I didn't pick it as an option back then. But I did pick it when I came to do my master's. So I came back to Oxford to do the BCL, the Bachelor of Civil Law, confusingly called a Bachelor of Civil Law when it's a master's degree, something you have to explain now until eternity whenever you put this on your CV. So I selected family law at that time because there are a few things, I think, that law concerns which are more important than family. We all have a family. We are defined by those family relationships. The things that happen to us as children have an impact on the rest of our lives. And some of the most important relationships that we will ever have, relationships with children, with partners, husbands and wives, are held together, are glued together by family law. And the problem is that family law kicks in usually when things have gone wrong. So this is what really compelled me about studying family law the first time. It was an incredible opportunity to work with some really amazing academics in Oxford, like Rachel, who I mentioned before, Jonathan Herring, who's another professor in family law, are absolutely fantastic. And so when I came to do my PhD, I wanted to bring these interests in family together with interests I had about human rights and equality law, and to think about how those subjects overlapped. And that's where some of those ideas we talked about before were being kind of came up with and developed. And I very heartily recommend to anybody who is considering studying family law to do so, because it is an incredibly rewarding subject, one that I think has a huge amount to offer and is sometimes a bit overlooked by students. I think it's something that's very, very interesting. Now, your second question, yeah, this was a project I participated in a long time ago. There was a link with, I think, Turpin and Miller which is a local law firm in Oxford, and I was very keen to be involved. It didn't require a lot of cleverness, I have to say. Mostly it was about listening. It was about organizing papers, taking some effective notes to help the solicitors to give advice and to help out these individuals. And what I took away from it was the incredible vulnerability that those in prisons experience. Many of the people in the prisons had done some bad things, and they were facing the possibility of being removed from the United Kingdom. These are huge decisions that get made. So it's so important that when you do face deportation, you have the opportunity to put forward your case effectively, to explain any mitigating circumstances, any rights that might be engaged. And that's where two things: it's access to legal aid, so access to support that will allow you to articulate those arguments, and also accessibility within a prison or other sort of detention setting. Those are really difficult questions about having that access. So being there, I wasn't doing a lot of really clever stuff. It was more that my presence there was helping to facilitate some amazing legal aid lawyers to be able to help and support these individuals to put forward a fair case. And if I was to make some more constitutional point about it, it goes to show that when we talk about things like the rule of law and we talk about rights, we can't separate out access to justice, the accessibility of a lawyer and legal aid from the existence of those rights. And indeed, the European Court of Human Rights has made the same point, that understanding rights in an abstract way is not helpful. We need to think about those rights being effective and that people can actually access them in a meaningful way. So I also would very much advise anybody to take up opportunities to volunteer, even if you're doing what I was doing, which was, you know, handling bits of paper and doing little, you know, bits of admin work. Because even if you can be humble enough to do something like that at whatever stage you're at in your education, it can really help other people to do some really important stuff, and you can be a little part in helping promote access to justice.
Thank you so much for your answer, and thank you so much for coming on today to talk about this subject.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rach. It's been a real pleasure. I've very much enjoyed answering your questions and also revisiting a paper that I enjoyed writing and thinking about. So I was delighted to hear your questions and to talk about this today.